When you buy fish at the supermarket, they're generally labeled wild-caught or farmed or sustainable, indicating something about how the fish were raised and how they ended up in the seafood case. What you don't know is the human cost of getting that fish to the market and then to your plate. Our guest, E. Benjamin Skinner, spent 6 months investigating conditions for the largely Indonesian crew on fishing vessels that carry a South Korean flag and operate in the waters off the coast of New Zealand. He wrote about what he found for an article titled "The Fishing Industry's Cruelest Catch," published recently in Bloomberg Businessweek. E. Benjamin Skinner is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Ben, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your article begins with a man named Yusril. It's not his real name, but that's where your story starts. Tell us about Yusril.
Sure. Yusril, who's, as you say, I've changed his name to protect his identity, is a fisherman from a poor fishing village in central Java, the largest island in the Indonesian archipelago. And this individual had sought work for a second time on international fishing vessels as a result of not being able to feed his family, which was just about to expand. His wife was 8 months pregnant. He went to a recruiter in East Jakarta, found a job that he was told would pay him $260 a month, which was twice the minimum wage in central Java. What he didn't understand were the extraordinary conditions of indentured servitude that would come with that job.
In fact, he signs this document without reading it. Some of it is actually written in English, so he probably couldn't have understood it anyway.
Sure, although he very quickly understood what he'd signed up for when he began to realize he was locked into this job. Among other stipulations in the contract, if he walked away, he would submit essentially all of his family property. That was written into that contract. The hours would be unlimited. He was essentially told if for whatever reason he walks away, there will be extreme financial consequences for him and his family.
In fact, you're talking about $3,500. That would be essentially the fine that they would pay,
right?
Which is an enormous amount of money in this country. I can only imagine what it is in a place like Java.
Right. And he had handed over a title to this very small plot of subsistence farm that his family had had for generations. And so that was the collateral that was held against him.
Are we talking about a desperate man looking to help support his family?
That's exactly the situation.
And the ship that he gets a job on is Melilla?
Exactly. It was one of two Melilla ships that were operating as Korean-flagged foreign charter vessels in what New Zealand refers to as its exclusive economic zone between 12 and 200 miles out off the coast of New Zealand.
And what kind of fish do they catch?
They were catching a whole range of fish, most particularly squid, hoki, southern blue whiting, among others. They would catch ling and a range of fish that eventually would wind up in American markets, we believe.
And I do want to get to all of that.
Sure.
but he signed up knowing that it was going to be tough. These would be tough conditions, but it turned out to be really abusive conditions that he and some of the crew members lived under.
Right. These were conditions where he was essentially, as the contract had stipulated, the hours were unlimited, and that meant when a catch was hauled in, they would sometimes have to work up to 30 hours straight in very, very dangerous conditions without proper safety equipment. Injuries were rife. We discovered at least two deaths off the Melilla ships in the last 10 years. There's no question that working on fishing vessels, deep-sea fishing vessels, is always going to be tough work.
Even under the best conditions.
Even under the best conditions.
Right.
But in these conditions, they were not only physically abused and verbally abused, but there was endemic sexual abuse that was reported not only by Yusril but by other crew members. Yusril reported that on the previous ship that he had been fishing on, which was also operating in New Zealand's exclusive economic zone. This was one of the Dong Wan vessels that one of his friends, a shipmate, had been very seriously sexually assaulted, possibly raped. These are issues that are, I should say, largely taboo to discuss in traditional Indonesian society, and yet they bore witness.
Well, they were with, and do you think that's a common experience on these fishing vessels? Obviously, you're focusing on very specific vessels in a very specific part of the world, but
yeah.
I mean, this is very disturbing.
I should say that the overall picture of foreign charter vessels in New Zealand is a very varied one. And the New Zealand government has taken this issue seriously of late as a result of a ministerial inquiry that was ongoing at the time that I was doing my investigation. It seems that in some of the instances, the foreign charter vessels have no allegations of serious labor abuse. That was not the case in the fishing vessels that we were focusing on.
Yusril, obviously putting in long hours under very difficult conditions. He was paid nothing for the first 3 months. Did I read that right?
He was paid nothing for the first 3 months. Part of the contract stipulated that he would be given some cash for unloading. The catch here is that when he was being paid, it was going through the recruiters. They would hold 30% of whatever he was paid, and if he didn't complete his work at the end, he would not be paid. So fundamentally, what we're talking about here is complete control over not only the financials of the situation, complete control by the recruiters over the financials of the situation, but by the physical movement of the individuals. And that, for me, is what constitutes slavery. If you can't walk away from your work, it's slavery.
Well, and just picking up on that, obviously when you're on a vessel out in the middle of the ocean somewhere, you're not going to be able to walk away from that. Obviously, you're in a sense a captive on that particular vessel. You get into port, I guess there's the opportunity to leave.
Right. And their movements were tightly controlled on the port. But fundamentally, they were told if you walk away and you don't return in by X hour, then we will report your situation to the New Zealand authorities. They will revoke your visa and they will deport you. And when you get back home, the traffickers will take their due. This was not just the situation on the Malala ships. This was the situation on several other vessels that we talked about, that we investigated. Fundamentally, the New Zealand government, they've acknowledged this now by virtue of that ministerial report. Right. Have had problems. The Department of Labor, the Immigration Office, has very often complied with the fishing company's request to deport these individuals. Fundamentally, as I've seen in 10 years of reporting on this, when traffickers play on slaves' fear of authority, and when those authorities play into their fears, that reinforces the trafficking.
And if you talk about traffickers, are we talking about the agency that hires these people, the boat upon which they are working,
sure,
the company that owns the boat?
I should be very clear, because this is a term in international law. Human trafficking is the recruitment, the harboring, or the transport of individuals for the purposes of forcing labor out of them. So it's essentially anybody that's involved in that chain. So it's not only the people that are doing the abuse on the ships, the officers, but it would also mean the recruiters.
Now, Yusril I don't know if he called you or contacted you to say, and maybe as a result of your investigation or some of the investigation that New Zealand is doing, that he feared for his life, or there were people in his house, or that he felt in some kind of danger.
Yeah, and I should be very clear on this. I don't know where the command and control of the agents who went out and found and went after Yusril, where that originated from. I will say that the my source immediately told me, and a source additional to Yusril, a fixer that I was using on the ground in Indonesia, said that the people that came and sent him into hiding and were attempting to coerce him and his brother to sign a document giving up their claims for basic human rights, that those individuals came from the same recruiting agency as had originally put together that contract for Yusril and his shipmates.
So where is Yusril today? Do you know? Does anyone know?
You know, I know, but I'm not going to discuss that.
All right. But he's in hiding somewhere?
He's in hiding. He is getting protection. It's a very difficult situation for him, both because of, you know, the nature of his of you know,
the allegations.
Because he's hidden, and because he has to feed his family.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, fundamentally, we so easily forget that when slaves come out of these situations, they still have to eat. They still have to, you know, find some way of feeding their family. And now he's been completely blacklisted by not only that in recruiting agent, but he claims by the others that are working in as a cartel, and he can't go abroad and work internationally.
Do you think of him as a whistleblower?
Sorry?
As a whistleblower?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, to me, whistleblower has a sort of either a neutral or maybe even sometimes a negative connotation. Mm. I
didn't mean it that way.
I see him as somebody who is a survivor and has chosen to bear witness. Mm.
Do you think, I mean, it's a very disturbing article to read. Obviously, when you hear about the conditions and what is frankly alleged in this article, but do you think this is unusual when we think about the fishing industry? And for those of us that eat fish, you know, it raises all these questions about ethical eating.
Mm. I think these are questions that must be asked, and which is why we were asking them.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you know, it's my job as a reporter to report, to go and to seek the truth and to tell it. It's the American consumers, not only the, you know, consumers of food, but the consumers of the information in the article,
sure,
to decide what to do with that information and to decide whether they want to know more about what they're putting in their bodies.
Right. Well, we're almost up at a break here, and I'm thinking about, you know, the dolphin-free tuna. I mean, there was such an uproar, I should say, when people saw the conditions that tuna was caught in, and things changed. We don't have pictures. You know how pictures can inspire people to change their behavior?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
We don't have pictures of Yusril.
We do.
Oh, we do.
Yeah. They ran the print edition.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation talking with E. Benjamin Skinner about an article that he wrote recently in Bloomberg Business Week. The article titled "The Fishing Industry's Cruelest Catch," and it's based on a 6-month investigation looking at conditions on some of these fishing vessels that work off the coast of New Zealand. He's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Please Touch Museum supports WHYY and welcomes Word Girl from PBS on Thursday, March 29th at 11 a.m. at the museum. It's an opportunity for families to meet this favorite TV character and take pictures together. Please Touch Museum is located just off Interstate 76 with plenty of on-site parking. Word Girl, Thursday, March 29th at 11 a.m. More information online at pleasetouchmuseum.org.
Tonight, it's special coverage from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for a recap of today's arguments. That's special coverage from NPR News. The Supreme Court debates health care.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY. The American family has undergone radical shifts since the days of Leave It to Beaver. Remarriages, multiracial families, surrogates, same-sex partners, makes trying to explain a family's relations tricky.
We reinforce with our kids that we are a family, that we look different, but that there are all different kinds of families.
We talk about complicated family trees next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with E. Benjamin Skinner. He spent 6 months investigating conditions for fishermen working off the coast of New Zealand. He wrote about it in a recent edition of Bloomberg Businessweek. He was told about debt bondage, abuse, and coerced labor, something he calls modern-day slavery. Again, he's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, and in fact, for about the last decade or so, has been writing about slave conditions around the world. Going back to the story, so we're talking about an Indonesian crew, mm-hmm. a ship that carries a South Korean flag. They work off the coast of New Zealand. Mm-hmm. We know the U.S., we import most of our fish from around the world.
86%.
Almost all of the fish that we import from all over the world. Is there any chance that what Yusuf was fishing has ended up on our plate?
There is a distinct chance. And I should say categorically, first of all, I can't get into too many details in terms of sources and methods to protect a lot of the sources. Mm-hmm. But from the best of to the best of our ability, we've been able to determine that there is a higher probability, particularly among squid, that if you're eating squid from New Zealand, there's a higher chance that it was caught on one of the vessels mm-hmm. that we've identified as having at least one reported case of slave labor. Wow. And so we name a couple of the companies in the piece that we believe have a higher probability of being infected with this. But you'll notice I'm parsing my language very carefully.
Yes, I do notice that.
And the reason for that is we can't be 100%. One of the stunning things that I found out about this is that even as a consumer, if I want to find out how the hands that touched the food that is on my on my plate before I put it in my mouth, I can't. Generally speaking, because most of these companies won't tell you. I can't tell you the number of times that we heard the word proprietary when asking about who the distributors were, who the importers were, who the original fishing companies were, where the vessels were, all this kind of thing. It is an industry. I think it's fair to characterize the industry as being shrouded in secrecy.
And you talk to people at Costco, Whole Foods, other food companies in the U.S.
That's correct. Yeah, and I can't get into too many details about the specific individuals that I talked to.
But in terms of kind of withholding this proprietary information, that was their response.
Well, in some cases, in other cases, they just wouldn't comment on record. Uh-huh.
I'm looking at something from Sanford, and that's one of the New Zealand companies, and it looks as if they read your article in Bloomberg and are taking a look at some of these standards practices that you write about. Mm. Do you take them seriously?
I do. I will say that I was, frankly, initially concerned about the response from the CEO of Sanford, Eric Barrett, who his response was essentially, we are investigating to try to find out who is making these allegations, yes. which, smacks of something other than a good faith investigation about the broader conditions on board the ships. It smacks, frankly, of a witch hunt. Yeah. But since then, I've been quietly watching and noted that they have said that they are initiating changes. As with everything, as an interminably skeptical journalist, I will continue to watch and wait and withhold judgment.
But the fact that Youssef felt in danger, was that as a result of Sanford's investigation into these practices, or there's no way to know?
I can't say that definitively, no. I don't know. Eric Barrett, who's the CEO of Sanford, has denied that publicly in a national New Zealand radio and interview. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
As you said, we import about 85-86% of our fish. Does a lot of it come from this part of the world off the coast of New Zealand? You mentioned some of the fish, but is that where we largely get our catch?
It's actually not the main source of seafood. In the United States, fish comes from all over.
Yeah.
And 86% of the fish is now imported. That's up over the last 20 years. It continues mm-hmm. to grow as a share of the seafood on our plates. The bottom line for me personally, when I go into a restaurant now, is I always ask where the fish is from.
Mm-hmm.
This was tough for me. I'm a pescatarian. I decided when I turned 30 that I was going to give up red meat, and the alternative for protein for me was fish. And, you know, it's put a sort of kink in my rhythm to think about the very real human cost of some mm-hmm. of the fish that we eat.
If it comes from New Zealand, I get the sense that you would select something else on the menu.
Yeah, but then again, if it comes from, if it's shrimp from Thailand, read the Solidarity Center report from 10 years ago. You know, the thing about this is on the human rights, the modern day slavery and human rights labeling and sourcing and transparency issue, we are about 20 years, as a country, the United States is about 20 years behind the environmental movement.
Uh-huh.
You can go into Whole Foods and you can see all kinds of labeling for sustainability. But labeling for labor conditions just, for the most part, doesn't exist. The one exception is fair trade, but even fair trade, as we've seen in the case of a colleague at Bloomberg, Cam Simpson's report into fair trade farms in Burkina Faso, I believe, catching that were making or harvesting cotton, picking cotton for Victoria's Secret underwear. Even in that case, this fair trade certified farm, it turned out, wasn't using child slave labor.
Why do you think it's easier to figure out the environmental impact than it is the human impact?
Mm.
I mean, why? And I know that you've been looking at this slavery issue for some time now.
I don't think it necessarily is easier. I think it's just what the companies have chosen to focus on. I think the other problem, frankly, with modern-day slavery and human trafficking is that very often victims don't self-identify. Getting to the core of the issue, you're talking about a category of people that have been extraordinarily marginalized, have never really been given comprehensive, you know, list of here are your rights. You know, you have the right to walk away from work. You have the right to speak out. You have the right to some access to an ombudsman or somebody who you can complain to about these conditions. You have the right to be paid a certain amount of money. I mean, you know, the fact that Indonesian workers would willingly accept a contract paying them $260 a month for work in a country where the minimum wage on board those vessels is $12 per hour, and in many cases those individuals were, you know, working unlimited hours, up to 30 hours straight, and other ships we heard about, University of Auckland Business School report reported up to 56 hours straight. So, you know, why would anybody accept that? A, desperation. B, lack of knowledge of rights.
In fact, one of the things that you have said about slavery, which is illegal around the world, is that we have, I don't know if we have more slaves now than we ever did, but that hasn't stopped the slave population.
It hasn't. And according to a recent report by the U.S. State Department, the global recession has driven more to take those risks. I want to be very clear here because, as you say, I've been writing about this for some time, and too often the term slavery is thrown about as a metaphor. If you look up in Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the number one definition is drudgery or toil.
Meaning hard work?
Meaning hard work, yeah. And the definition that I've adopted, which is originally derived from the 1930 forced labor definition that the International Labor Organization put out, my definition of a slave is someone who is forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence, for no pay beyond subsistence. By that mere definition, there are more slaves in the world today than at any point in human history.
Do we know how many slaves there are?
Again, this is a hidden population. They don't self-identify. They don't stand in line and raise their hands and wait for the census to be taken. These are individuals who are largely hidden, but the best estimates that we have are between 12.3 million, which is the International Labor Office estimate, and the high end is 27 million, which is the number that is most commonly cited, and that's a number that was originally put forth by Kevin Bales of a terrific anti-slavery organization called Free the Slaves, based here in the United States.
And that's our guest, E. Benjamin Skinner, today in Radio Times. In fact, a couple of years wrote an award-winning book called A Crime So Monstrous about slavery. We're talking also about a piece that he had recently in Bloomberg Business Week about an investigation into the conditions for fishermen working off the coast of New Zealand. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Larry from Mullica Hill to join us. Larry, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Go right ahead.
I'm retired from New Jersey marine fisheries, and I moved to Hawaii 12 years ago when I retired. I'm back in Jersey now. But I visited Honolulu Harbor, and I was curious to see five longline tuna boats registered in Barnegat Light, New Jersey. So I wanted to track down the skipper and chat with him, which I could never do. He was very elusive. But all the people that I left notes with on those boats were, I think, Vietnamese, and they were not allowed to step off the boat onto the dock in U.S. waters. And I'll take my answer off the air, but can your guest say something about the status of those fishermen and the economics and, you know, they're unloading fish in...
Sure.
American waters, not New Zealand.
Larry, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Thanks very much, Larry. Of course, I can't comment on that particular case because I don't know anything more than what Larry just said. But the I will say that in the United States, there is a fairly robust response to human trafficking. And I did see this as a contrast with the New Zealand response to this. The New Zealand government, when I asked them, claimed that there was not one single case of human trafficking on board that they know about on board any of these foreign charter vessels. There, in the United States, there has been in every state in the country, there have been trafficking victims found. The estimate from the Justice and State Departments are that between 14,000 and 17,000 are trafficked into slavery in the United States each and every year. There are individuals in government that take a very vigorous attitude towards human trafficking in the U.S. government. And I think we should feel heartened by that. But we should also take note that the amount of money that is spent to fight the traffic in human beings is very low, and it was cut in the last budget cycle. Right now we're in the appropriations season again, and that is an interesting debate that citizens may want to get involved with.
Larry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm actually looking something from the State Department. This goes back almost a year ago, but it talks about Thai slavery and food security, the fishing fleet, talking about some, I guess it looks like Thai fishing operations and questions about slavery as well.
Sure, yeah. The State Department annually puts out a report on monitoring and aimed at monitoring and combating slavery worldwide. This is the Office to Monitor and Combat trafficking in persons. It's an annual review of every country on Earth, placing them into tiers based on how they're doing in response to slavery allegations. And I think this is something that, again, concerned citizens should use as a resource and, you know, look at Vietnam, see if there are any mentions of the fishing industry, mm-hmm. and look at the U.S. review. And by the way, I want to be very concrete. If Larry or anybody else out there has any ideas about slave labor conditions or any other kind of trafficking situations, there's a National Human Trafficking Hotline. It's 888-3737-888. And they can call and they can report whatever they feel are credible allegations or even just ask questions mm-hmm. about human trafficking.
I want to go back to the fact that you do eat fish, and obviously you've been writing about fish. So how do you make that decision when you're at a restaurant or you're at the supermarket? I mean, so you're concerned about New Zealand, you're concerned about other countries in, I guess, Southeast Asia or Asia as well.
Yeah.
Is there a place that you feel comfortable getting a fish, buying a fish?
Or
a certain kind of fish that you feel like is caught by people who are paid a decent wage?
Yeah, there's the last fish that I felt good about 100% was I caught off the off of Key West myself.
That you personally caught?
Yeah. I honestly cannot say that I know much about the fish that I catch.
Mm-hmm.
I ask as many questions as I can, but fish, because so much of it is imported in this country, is a difficult thing to track. And, you know, I talk to servers of goodwill at the restaurants that I go to, and I talk to retailers of goodwill at the stores that I buy. They just don't know.
Oh, let me get Brian from Harrisburg to join us on Radio Times. And, Brian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I just want to commend your guests for the reporting that I've heard you talking about. I think that's it's really interesting, and I'm glad that there are people doing that work.
Thanks, Brian.
My question, I heard you say earlier on about asking in the restaurants about where the fish has come from. And I know that that's an awkward thing to do, but, you know, I'm wondering if you have practical tips for consumers of, you know, when you get that answer, what do you do with that? Or what are the answers that you're hoping to hear?
Go ahead.
Well, this is one of these things where we are really just at the outset of awareness on this. And so we very quickly, I would say that consumers, if they are concerned about this, you know, and not satisfied with the initial responses they get, to press further, to essentially do what I do and try to get to the truth with regards to what it is that they're putting in their bodies. Now, that may mean going, you know, finding out who the distributor is. What's the name of the company that you bought this fish from as a restaurant? If they won't tell you that, ask them why won't they tell you that? You know, I mean, this was welcome to my world for the last 6 months on this. But if you
trying to get to the literally get to the bottom of it.
Exactly. But if you are concerned about this, you should ask. And mm-hmm. and I should say, in some respects, the average consumer will have more power than a journalist on this, because you know, because of the reputation of many journalists, and because companies won't open up. Most of these companies, at least in rhetoric, say, "Well, we will be responsive to our customers. Mm-hmm. They are the bosses ultimately."
Brian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation with E. Benjamin Skinner. He's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism, and that's at Brandeis University. Wrote a book called A Crime So Monstrous about the world of modern-day slavery. And he also had a piece recently in Bloomberg Businessweek uncovering some of the brutal conditions for fishermen who work off the coast of New Zealand. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center and Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham have been awarded 3-year terms of accreditation in radiation oncology by the American College of Radiology and the American Society for Radiation Oncology. This accreditation represents Fox Chase's commitment to the high level of quality, patient safety, and technical rigor as specified by national experts in the field.
More at foxchase.org and foxchase.org/Buckingham. Fox Chase Cancer Center, hearts plus minds.
On the next Fresh Air, Rachel Maddow, the popular MSNBC host, talks about her show, her life, and her new book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power, in which she traces the increasing power of a president to take America to war and how the public has become disconnected from the consequences of war. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The case for the Affordable Care Act continues. Many insurance companies support it because they'll see lots of new customers, including people who are sick and are expensive to cover. But they only agreed to do that if everyone was covered. Also, are elephants in a losing battle with humankind? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with E. Benjamin Skinner and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You have been investigating, writing about, talking about slavery for about, what, a decade now?
A little bit over a decade.
How did you get? Don't remind me. I know. It's a hard beat to have. How did you get involved in this?
Start with the kindling, which is my upbringing. I was raised in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a place that talks about social justice a lot. I was raised Quaker, come from a long line of Quakers on my mother's side. Quakers were some of the original abolitionists. And so in Quaker meeting growing up, we would talk as much about Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman as we would about Jesus and Moses. Fast forward to my first job out of college at the Council on Foreign Relations. I felt that I had terrific access there. I felt that I was coming off of a great education at Wesleyan University. I wanted to do something with it. And I picked up Kevin Bale's book, Disposable People. And that was really the spark that lit the kindling. And from there, I appreciated what Kevin had done in terms of parsing the definition, in terms of establishing the definition as far as I was concerned, in terms of counting, in terms of, you know, giving an estimate anyway of the numbers. But, you know, in many cases, it's the worst people that have the best quotes, and you have to qualify it when you're going to quote Joseph Stalin. But Stalin was supposed to have said, the death of a million men is a statistic. The death of one man is a tragedy. And what I wanted to do was to get beyond the numbers, to go and find the individuals that would bear witness and tell their own stories.
In fact, you have done that around the world and talked to people that are enslaved or enslaved, and also to the people that own them and abuse them.
And traffic in them.
Yeah.
And this was... this was the narrative that I tried to weave together in this book, A Crime So Monstrous. The individuals that I was speaking with were on five different continents. I was witness to slave sales on those continents. In some cases, for the book only, I would go undercover and actually talk to traffickers and in an attempt to parse their motives and get a sense of how much human beings cost, for example. And the frightening thing is, 5 hours from where we are right now, I was able to negotiate in broad daylight for the sale of a 12-year-old girl. And I did not pay for this girl, I should say, at the outset. I did not buy this girl. But on the street in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, less than an hour from the airport in Port-au-Prince, I was offered a 12-year-old girl, with the explicit use of this girl being for domestic slavery. And at a certain point, the trafficker leaned in and said, this is rather a delicate question, but do you want this child as a partner as well as a domestic? And my translator made it perfectly clear what he meant by partner. He was talking about sexual abuse. The asking price for that girl was $100. The negotiated price within 2 minutes was $50.
And they speak in code, obviously. I mean, part of this transaction is a coded language.
Well, in this case, I was upfront about being a journalist. And I was asking very explicit questions. And some of this was coded. Sure, they didn't use the term slave, for example. they would say helper. But I made it perfectly clear I was not going to pay this child. I made it perfectly clear that the role that I wanted this child for was to cook, to clean, to carry water, that the child would sleep on the floor. According to the United Nations and a UNICEF study, prior to the earthquake, there were between 175,000 and 300,000 child domestic slaves in Haiti. After the earthquake,
who knows? But one would assume more because of all the chaos and dislocation.
Possibly, although it could also mean that
there are
less homes and therefore less homes to clean. So it could go either way.
Yeah.
And I will say, President Clinton approached me in Davos right immediately after at the World Economic Forum immediately after the earthquake, and he said, "I think this is our chance to end the Restavec system. The Restavec system is the system of child domestic slavery. It takes will, though. It takes nations and men and women and working together to solve these problems.
But I would assume, I mean, economy plays a role. If a country is poor, the mm-hmm. poverty and slavery, I'm not saying going hand in hand, but there has to be some connection there. Warfare or conflict, chaos, all the things that can dislocate people.
Sure, absolutely. Poverty does play a role, but poverty is not the sole determinant. Corruption, lack of knowledge of rights, those have to factor mm-hmm. in as well. But you're absolutely right. There has been an attempt in the early part of this modern day abolitionist movement to focus on the crime and the isolate without looking at the drivers. Mm-hmm. And I think when that is the focus, certainly poverty is not the only reason for this, but to deny the absolute role of poverty as a driver in modern day slavery is like denying the role of gravity in rainfall. It is an enormously important factor.
I sit in this beautiful, hermetically sealed room talking to guests who have done things. In your case, have talked to traffickers and have talked to people who are slaves. And I've never been in the position to know or to wonder, what should I do? Here I am mm-hmm. talking, let's say, to a 12-year-old girl who someone may abuse and sexually abuse and physically abuse. Do I protect her? Do I get her off the streets? Do I find a place for her to live? Do I adopt her? I mean, all the questions that must go through your head in this particular beat that you have.
To be clear, in that instance in Haiti, I was not presented with the girl. He was mm-hmm. going to go and recruit her from a family, and right. he actually invited me to come up into the hills and choose which one I wanted. She existed. I obviously declined.
Yes.
He had a particular girl in mind. I obviously declined. I told him not to disrupt that family. There have been other instances. I did an article for Time magazine a couple of years ago in the underground brothels around the World Cup stadiums. And
in South Africa.
Yeah, in South Africa. I talked to one girl who was dying alone in a hospice, who had been trafficked a year and a half earlier, who had full-blown AIDS, who had tuberculosis, and who was 3 months pregnant. A week after I talked to her, she died. Less than an hour after I talked to her, my photographer, who was a person of faith, a deep person of deep faith, said this was the hand of God. Less than an hour after I talked to her, we happened to find her best friend, who had been sold with her, on the street.
Wow.
In a situation like that, where she actually asked us for help, and she said she's 15 years old, she needs help getting out of this situation, getting away from these violent traffickers. She'd tried to run away 3 times. In a situation like that, you cross the line as a journalist and
yeah.
you get involved.
Yeah.
And
because these are human beings.
Because these are human beings. And at the end of the day, we got her out. We got her to a shelter, and I found a sponsor for her and for school. It's a stretch to call her lucky, given what she went through over the time that she was trafficked. But she's HIV negative, and she has another chance at life.
Yeah. That I saw that time, read that Time magazine article, and I saw the picture of the girl who died. I mean, she's in a bed. She has this rather faraway look on her face.
Hmm.
Haunting.
Yeah. She was 16 years old when she died.
Yeah, that's got to be a tough beat to have. Let me just reintroduce you. And E. Benjamin Skinner, our guest today on Radio Times, and he's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. We're talking about his work, understanding the world of trafficking and slavery, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get Gary on from Bryn Mawr. Go ahead, Gary. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. It's a great program.
Thank you.
My question refers to something earlier, but when your guest pointed out that it's been easier to identify products that are green, that are seen as being sustainable, and that's even become popular now in ecological terms, how would we go about getting the same information, identifying the same products in terms of social sustainability and social justice? Is there anything that might be a model for us as consumers to think about?
That's
just
a good...
to know this and to begin to direct our shopping that way.
Indeed. Ben, go ahead.
I think the green movement is absolutely a model for social activism on this. A good model for laws, for a would-be federal law and state laws worldwide is something that just went online in California. SB 657, which is the California Transparency and Supply Chains Act, which went into effect in the beginning of January, and requires all companies that make over $100 million annually and file tax receipts in the state of California to disclose what they are doing to monitor and combat slavery within their supply chains. And they don't have to be doing anything. This is the nuance of the law. They don't have to be doing anything, but they have to disclose what they're doing, or whether they're doing nothing, or whether they don't know. And I found over the course of this Bloomberg investigation, when we were speaking with companies at the end about what we'd found, that the largest companies were extraordinarily responsive on this. Walmart and Safeway were very vigorous in their attitude, and they were keenly aware of exactly what their responsibilities were under SB 657.
Mm-hmm. And it shows what publicity can do, right?
Yeah. But like all laws, I have to add this, like all laws, it's only as good as the citizens choose to make it important. It's not who in Washington or Wellington or any other capital is against slavery. It's how high up in their inbox it is.
Yeah.
And it won't be high up in their inbox if it's not high up in the outbox of citizens.
Let me get, it looks like Harriet from Phoenixville to join us on Radio Times. And Harriet, go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you so much for addressing this incredible topic. It is very inspiring, the work that you've done. I think I first read one of your articles in Utney. Maybe it was an excerpt in Utney, but it was a story about the Port-au-Prince story that you just shared with the listening audience. And at that time, it inspired me to contact the Phoenixville School District where I live and say, look, I have a 12-year-old child, and this would be a wonderful topic to bring to our middle school and say maybe we could sponsor a child to get them out of slavery, or sponsor a school that helps bring children out of slavery where it's happening. And have you had any luck with that around the country? Have you seen people bring that activism into their community on a local basis?
Harriet, thanks for the call. Ben, go ahead.
Absolutely. You know, I was just speaking yesterday at Franklin and Marshall College here in Pennsylvania in Lancaster, and there was the person who had invited me to come and speak was a young woman named Carol, who had been a student. She was then a freshman at Franklin. She's now a freshman at Franklin Marshall. She had been a student at Emma Willard School. I'd spoken there a couple of years earlier. And the students got together and said, hey, what do we know about the products that are being sold in our cafeterias? What do we know about the cotton that is going into the Emma Willard shirts? We need to be fair trade. And because of student activism, because of these, the activism of these 14 to 18-year-olds, they got together and they pushed the board and they made Emma Willard the first fair trade school in the country. It's a great start. It's a great start. As I say, fair trade is not the end of the story, but you know, again, consumers have the power, but they have to act together.
Harry, thanks for the call. Let me get Nick from Philadelphia to join us. And Nick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. What is the United States government and the Obama administration doing to combat child slavery and human trafficking?
In this country, Nick, or other countries?
In the United States.
In the United States.
I mean, in other countries as well, but just the subject in general.
Indeed.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it's an excellent question. The Obama administration has some of the, to my eye, the most accomplished, the most distinguished individuals in the movement, in the fight against modern day slavery, who are in positions of power. Ambassador Lou DeBaca, who heads up the Office of Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, is one of the most decorated federal prosecutors in history. He's put away more human traffickers. When he was at the Justice Department, he put away more human traffickers than anybody. He's now heading up the State Department's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. He commanded a towering budget. This is the one time I'll use sarcasm, of $21 million in the first year. That was cut by a quarter, thanks to the across the board budget cuts instituted by Congress in the last budget cycle.
So we're talking $15-16 million bucks
to fight slavery worldwide. Bear in mind that according to the best estimates that we have, slavery and human trafficking yield some $32 billion annually worldwide. That is not a fair fight. Now it bears mentioning that the amount of money that we spend on an annual basis to fight the traffic in human beings is less than we spend on a daily basis to fight the traffic in illegal drugs. And that is not to diminish the relative horrors of smoking pot, but it is to say which is the more monstrous crime.
E. Benjamin Skinner, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder with Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.